Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
I had an amazing crew at Williams Hyde throughout the years. You know, we would go through an assistant wine. I say go through because I hired people that didn't want to be my assistant winemaker. I wanted people that wanted my job and were ambitious and smart. I wanted them outthinking me. And if you surround yourself with people smarter than you, you achieve a lot more. So while we're all learning together, you know, I had these assistant winemakers stay 3-4 vintages, a couple of them maybe 5 vintages, but they're all now winemakers and general managers and production managers at other wineries. And that's great. I was able to help their careers blossom while we achieved the goal at Williams Hyde.
Again, those are leadership qualities that you hope that every organization has. But in your case, you just had this natural knack for knowing that almost organically. I mean, it was strategic, but it, for what you're describing, just that's how you are. That's
You can't make these. You can't grow grapes by yourself, and you can't make wine by yourself.
So you met in 2008. So obviously, something about Ryan stood out right away.
Yeah, Ryan. You know, and my recollection may be a little bit different than his, but I remember towards the end of harvest, we kept a couple of people around because we'd had a fairly large harvest.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of work to still do, so I couldn't let too many of the harvest go and harvest interns go, so they kept working. What I remember is Ryan coming to me, and I don't remember if it was before Christmas or shortly after Christmas. You know, am I going to be let go? I need to kind of get on with my life. And my response, I think, was something like, you're going to have to go find another job before I'm going to let you go, because it was too valuable to me in the cellar. I had a couple of interns that year that just, you know, I knew they were going to be great winemakers somewhere, someday. And you hold on to them as long as you can. And so, you know, he was married and said that he and Drina were going to think about starting a family. So he needed a little more stability then. And I was probably only paying him like $8 or $10 an hour back then. I doubt much more, right?
No, it was right in that realm. And you know, coming to Williams Hyde, that was an amazing experience because there was a little bit of that flexibility. So it was this harvest internship, but you know, he said, well, we also need a couple people afterwards, and sometimes that leads into the spring, and depending on the workload, maybe we need people for bottling. And so I thought in my head, well, this could be great. You know, I'll do a harvest there, and then if I do well, then I can continue on. And so I was kind of feeling that out, and then I had an opportunity come up in the springtime the following year, and to go basically manage a custom crush place, which you know, you were mentioning about sort of so much of the wine business is the people business, and I think that is, it's so true. It's you know, how do you, you know, I was just starting as just finished a year of internship, and now they're coming to me and saying, yeah, we want you to run the cellar at this custom crush place with 25 different winemakers, and you know, I'm thinking, that seems like a pretty big step, but I'm willing to take the challenge. And I think half of it was really, I did have the experience of managing other accounts. You know, in my previous work history, I was you know, doing software implementations and whatnot. And so I think that, you know, being able to work with other people well, and you know, being able to, you know, go and talk to the different winemakers and ask what they were trying to achieve and how can we in the cellar achieve that. And so I really learned a ton. Of course, you know, my first harvest at Williams Hyde, I was learning, you know, what the equipment was, you know, when you make it in your bathroom to making it on the full scale, you're learning pumps, you're learning, or not pumps at Williams Hyde, actually.
We had pumps that cleaned hoses, and
but
you know,
but it was tri-clover clamps and all the names. I remember there was the assistant winemaker, Phil, who had this thick Australian accent, and he would,
but none of us could understand. I wasn't even sure I actually hired Phil because he was an intern. And then he just showed back up, and I don't think he ever left.
That's hilarious.
But it's so funny. And Phil, what Ryan doesn't know kind of on the backside of that too, though, is that, you know, we all get calls about people that have worked for us. And I mean, I think, and he gets them from his winemaker buddies, you know, hey, this guy says he worked for you. What's his demeanor? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the questions were, why is he still there? It's like, because he's going to have to quit before I'm going to let him go. I'm not going to let him go until he decides to go. He probably can't live off of what I'm paying him, so yeah. I'm going to lose him at some point. But yeah. If you can snatch him up, snatch him up. And, yeah. You know, Ryan was, I think, the perfect person to go to Copan.
It's got to be good to hear that Bob had... So well, yeah. Much faith.
You know, I mean, Ryan knows. I mean, there's only so many people that really want to work as hard as we want to work. Or, you know, I mean, it's just, you never leave home. I mean, yeah. I'm an early morning person, so he probably gets more email. I know he does. He gets more emails from me between literally like 4:30 and 6:30 in the morning. And then I get more emails from him from like 11 p.m. to like 1 a.m. And so, you know, when I'm looking at my phone at 4:30 in the morning and an email came in from him 3 hours ago, I'm like, oh my God, don't you ever sleep, kind of thing.
But asleep when he sends emails.
Right. We just have these different cycles. But that the point being is that we're communicating kind of constantly.
Yeah.
You know, when it pops in your head and this is something that I think I want to discuss with him or mm-hmm. or may help him out, or he's communicating back to me, this is what we're doing, what do you think, kind of thing. You know, I think that's invaluable to have those kinds of people working with you all the time.
Yes. No, that kind of synergy is really important.
Yeah.
And I'm still on, I had to manage 25 winemakers because I've been around winemakers for a while.
Oh, man.
Herding cats is an understatement of the century. Yeah. I have, this is a whole separate podcast, I think.
Absolutely.
How you managed to pull that off.
you should get our wives in here.
Oh, man. Yeah.
They'll give you the, we probably don't want that.
No, let's.
In fact, we should edit this, that last comment.
Well, the fact that you're very well trained between the two of you in managing people and specifically winemaking people who are creative geniuses, but I'm sure are difficult to corral, put it this way. You can pretty much run the country. Any country.
And it's also, I was having lunch with a young winemaker last week and she was telling me, and she doesn't have a real big ego, and I just said, but she's been told to further her career, you need to, and I said, you don't need to have an ego, because I think we all have them.
Yeah.
You just need to learn to manage it. You need to manage it to your advantage and not come across with that ego.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being able to listen to other people and other people's ideas. And Ryan and I do this in tastings. We don't agree all the time on everything. Mm. And we haven't agreed on everything around here, but we find common ground because we're here to do a job for Three Sticks. This isn't about Bob and it's not about Ryan. It's about all the other people that work with us as well that are trying to, you know, get their kids to soccer practice and ballet practice and, you know, go to wine events and be a part of their community. You know, we have an obligation to them to make sure that we're keeping our end of the bargain in the winemaking. And that means compromising on things and finding that common ground. And a lot of times I think it's for the betterment anyway. You know, my ideas aren't always the best, you know.
But the fact that you're so self-aware that you're not attached to the exclusion of others, even though you can make an argument any day about the breadth and depth of the experience that you have.
Right, and we all have ideas and ways that we want to do things. And I remember when we showed up, Ryan asked me some pretty simple questions like, "What, you know, like how should we clean tanks? How do you want to sanitize tanks?" And I'm like, as long as it's clean, I don't, you know, there's probably 20 different ways to sanitize a tank.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with those and developed all those methods as an assistant winemaker right off the bat. And after like 2 years, I went to Bill and said, we need to make wine in winemaker. Like, this needs to be his position here. He needs to own this brand. And I don't know how long I will continue to work here. It could be another 20 years. It could be, I don't know. But my role here isn't to dictate to Ryan or Carl or Emily or anybody in the cellar that this is the way things need to be done. It needs to be a collaborative effort. Yeah. And when you have a good leader, you need to let them lead. You can't just choke them all the time.
It's interesting when you talk about protocols, because I think a lot of us romanticize what happens in the vineyard and in the cellar pretty heavily. And the wine, we have this image of the winemaker showing up and just making magic, whispering to barrels, but it really is hard work, and it's about cleanliness, it's about certain regimes that have to be replicatable and also communicated very well to people that are executing. And that's a huge part of what winemaking is, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's what I really learned at William Selyem that first year was, wine will make itself. If you take grapes and you crush them up and put them in a bucket or whatever, it'll turn into wine, and then it'll turn into vinegar, right? So there's this process. And so what we as winemakers have to do is keep it in that wine portion and make it taste really good. Mm-hmm. And so how do you do that time and time again? Well, you've got to keep the bad things out. You've got to keep things clean beforehand. And you've got to figure out how to make it taste good, in that process. And so, there's a lot of detail that goes into that. And there's a lot of finding, sort of talking about what Bob was saying earlier about, winemaking, fear being some of the part of winemaking that keeps you going. Well, it's not necessarily fear in all these cases, but it is, every one of these steps has the possibility of taking that wine down a different path.
Yeah.
And how do we keep it on the path that we want it to? And so a lot of those things are thinking of what could go wrong with this step, what could go wrong with this process, what could go wrong at this fermentation step. If I decide to push it this way, there's some benefits, but there are also some drawbacks. So really, every step of the way, and there are hundreds of those decisions along the path of making wine, how do you make each one of those decisions get you into the spot where you ultimately want to be? Because sometimes each of those decisions might not be exactly what you want to do, but you know it will eventually get you where you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Ultra cleanliness, or making sure that this tank, some winemakers will say, I'm a hands-off winemaker. I just let the grapes do what they want, and the natural flora from the vineyard will show through. And I think that there are components of that that's a great method for certain things, but it's totally not for others. There are other things that could go wrong with that. So you got to take the good and keep out the bad with all of those processes.
No, and I think it's such an important point, because again, people get attached to romantic terms like natural, organic, the wine makes itself. But yes, by itself it will turn to vinegar, right?
Yeah.
Without human intervention.
It'll go bad. Eventually, if you don't take care of it, it'll go bad.
Yeah. So winemaking, the key word is making, not watching for it to make itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's that human intervention that's very intentional, that's important to acknowledge. I also was listening very carefully to the accountability piece, because you've cited that when you worked at William Selyem, you knew these people personally, and they depended on you to make good wines. And you're also accountable to your peers, to your colleagues, to your interns, to make sure that they weren't working in the environment that produced a good result, and that they were taking pride in what they do, because it's a great thing. But then there's a consumer piece as well. Mm-hmm. The wine has to taste good, so it's so that's a lot. That's a lot to shoulder. It sounds almost nerve-wracking. Here you are, you have one shot a year, unless you make wine in Australia and New Zealand, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So you get two.
Yes, exactly. It's still not a lot.
Right.
And then Mother Nature just does what she's going to do. And then you have all these pieces of the puzzle that have to flow together. So, I mean, this whole romantic notion of just showing up and, you know, kind of imparting your magic is out the window. I mean, this is a lot of steps.
It's a bit of a burden, but I also think it's a bit of relief. I think if we had the capability to make 1,000 different wines or 100 different wines a year, I think you would probably be forced into trying to make the same wine every time, or if that's what your job was, to make this exact flavor profile every year, or every time you make that wine. To me, that would be a less interesting job than we have. I think the vineyard or the vintage differences that come through every year are a blessing, and you know, that's what makes wine interesting. And yes, we might not have seen that for 10 years, or it, you know, you have to go back in the memory bank to say, oh, this vintage was like this, or this growing season was like this other one, and let's, what did we do then, and what do we want to do differently this year? But that's kind of the beauty of it as well, where you're not forced to do the same thing every year, and you are kind of tweaking it, but you're letting the vintage show, and letting your version of that vintage show every time. So we're not making widgets.
No, and it's both nerve-wracking, I'm assuming, at times, and highly rewarding. And again, the people component, you get to share information, you get to maybe argue sometimes, but it's a creative process that I think is very stimulating. So for you, it kind of circled back from 2008, and then 11 years later, here you are. So you mentioned that when you heard that Ryan was being hired for the winemaking position, you wanted to
work with him. I was meeting with Bill and Tom Bonomi, the president of Bill's parent company, Price Family Wine Estates.
Price Family Vineyard.
Vineyards and Wine Estates. And, you know, they had mentioned that Ryan was going to come aboard. And that was huge for me, because I wanted to be able to work with someone that I knew would want to collaborate.
Yeah.
And walking in blind sometimes is tough.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't know the person, and you know, Ryan knows me, you know, you walk into a new situation, you're very enthusiastic, and I'm sure it was quite overwhelming for the seller in there, the people that were here before Ryan and I came, because we were making so many changes,
sure.
You know, or trying to start to implement some of the changes, including in the vineyards. I'm sure it was super overwhelming for Rob.
Yeah.
And, you know, it takes time to build those relationships, and it was nice to have kind of one person that you knew, okay, I could bounce anything off of. You weren't worried about saying what you wanted to say and what you needed to say to move things forward.
No, it's definitely, like you said, it's about teamwork and having that both simpatico but also professional relationship, and you have a lot of respect for one another. It's very helpful. Rob, you mentioned Rob Harris is a long term, I think 10 years at least that he's been with Bill Price.
I would say at least longer, maybe more.
Yeah, he's kind of a vineyard whisperer, so that's an interesting relationship right there. I actually also took note of the fact that you left William Selim and then you were pursuing other projects. I think a lot of people don't realize that you made that decision in isolation. You weren't just transitioning to another.
No. Yeah, I basically left a job before I had another job. So.
Which is in and
kind of unusual, especially leaving a position like William Selim. Yes. It's like, maybe, you know, where do you go? Maybe I could get a seller job at Romani Conti or something like that, right?
There you go.
You know? And I did that. It was a thoughtful process, definitely, on my part. You know, change is scary.
Yeah,
it really is for a lot of people. And I always had a difficult time changing positions or changing directions. But you also know when you just need to do something different.
Yeah.
And William Selim, I really felt like I had done more than what I had ever expected to do there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be able to do some other new things. I didn't want to kind of keep doing the same old thing.
You wanted to challenge yourself.
I needed, and intrigued me about working with Bill is that he had vineyards that I knew very well from tasting wines made from them, but I hadn't farmed them. I hadn't been on the vineyards and really gone through the whole cycle. So that opportunity was like, let's go try something new. That was really intriguing to me. Also the fact that I didn't have I told Bill I didn't want to do a non-compete. Not that I had other jobs that I wanted to do, but if other projects came up that seemed intriguing, mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to do that. And he was okay with that. And, that's unusual.
I would assume so. I mean, by all accounts, Bill Price is a brilliant business person that created a lot of value. And these vineyard choices are pretty stellar. I'm sure Rob helped, but he mm-hmm. made the final decision to acquire those properties. And they're some of the marquee vineyards in California and perhaps the world. So it's right. a big deal.
It is. So, that was very intriguing to me. And what keeps me intrigued, as we venture out onto other parts of Durell or other parts of Gap's Crown or Wallala, and we go back to Bill and say, so could we get any fruit from this area? And then we have to go back to Rob and he'd say, well, it's under contract with these guys. And so sometimes it was just opening up the dialogue, and mm-hmm. fruit that we've been looking at now for 4 and 5 years are still under contract on mm-hmm. those ranches, and we don't have access to them yet. But we've expressed interest if, for some reason, they mm-hmm. become available. And some of the blocks have. Some of the winemakers have moved on to different vineyards. They've bought their own. But some of the wineries have bought their own vineyards. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to get a hold of some of those other special spots within the
That's the exciting. Vineyard.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And it sounds like Bill gives you autonomy. As far as, he doesn't sound like a micromanager at all. It sounds like he has an overall vision, but the rest of it is really up to you guys.
He's very involved, but not micromanaging. We speak with him every week. We do tastings with him. He's hands off in terms of the decisions and whatnot as we're going through it. But mm-hmm. but he's a part of those decisions, and he's involved, and which is great. You get sort of the best of both worlds there.
So three
and his suggestions are really good. It's great to understand his palate, and he's a consumer as well.
Yeah.
And it's great to get feedback from him. And I think his business acumen and marketing acumen is what's really helped us here. Mm-hmm. Winemaking isn't the difficult part of this business. It's selling it. It really is. As much as we like to think that growing grapes and making wine, it's a relatively simple process. It's a tedious process. It's a meticulous process, but it's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. Selling and marketing and running the business is 90% of what the wine business is about.
Wow.
You can make the greatest wines in the world, and if you're not getting them out to the right consumers and the people that either can afford or want to buy these wines, you're not going to stay in business very long.
This is such important points. Again, we talk about the flavor profiles and various bits and pieces that has to do with the product, especially in the trade and media. We're awfully guilty of that. Marketing conversation seems to get lost. And the fact that you put such a huge value on it, 90%.
I do.
That needs to...
But I've been doing it for 40 years, too. He may not have that.
Yeah.
When I was younger, I would have said, oh, no, the winemakers drive this and the vineyards mm-hmm. drive that. But, the reality of it in the end is that, we're making here at Three Sticks, we're making a luxury product that people don't have to have to survive. It's something that they're usually rewarding themselves with, or, you know, it's a community where you're bringing people together and you're connecting kind of with your fellow human beings. And getting into their heads and helping them make that choice towards yours versus the other 400 brands here in just Sonoma County, that's a difficult thing to do, you know? It's not an easy process.
You know, what's particularly interesting is that, again, to reference William Selyem, that wine, at least, you know, early on, once, you know, the word got out how good it is, and, you know, the support of the major publications, you had a wait list, and it was heavily allocated. You couldn't get everything you wanted to buy. So in that sense, it sold itself. But now the scene has changed dramatically, hasn't it?
I think that thought process ended a good 10 years ago. Okay. And we had to work pretty hard, even at William Selyem at the end, during my tenure there. Not the end of William Selyem, but the end of my career there, where you were focused on, you know, trends, purchasing patterns, demographics.
Yeah.
You really had to drill down into who was buying your wine and why were they buying it. And I don't think you could start a brand today and just kind of do what William Selyem or Rocchioli or Kistler or, you know, some of the iconic brands, Sanquinon, you know, Manfred Krankel's project. I mean, who does that today? No one.
You don't think
I don't think you could repeat what they've done.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's probably, that ship has sailed. I don't think it's coming back.
No.
So you have to have a lot of savvy and be super aware about the selling part of it. So when I know Bill created Three Sticks, you know, before you joined the brand, and first of all, let's talk about the branding piece of it. Has it changed materially, you know, with your leadership?
Well, I mean, I think the most obvious one is the label did change.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we first came in, it was a black label with three sticks that were on it. And the three sticks actually is in reference not to any physical sticks, even though they're on the label. It's Bill's name is William Price III.
Thank you for clarifying.
And
that.
His buddies growing up called him Billy Three Sticks. So it was his, his name, his nickname growing up. And so from that standpoint, what we did, you know, we kind of looked at it and we kind of took a whole new look at the brand when we came on and said, what does this brand represent? What do we want it to represent? We have the Adobe just opened in 2014, so we have this new opportunity to see guests face to face, which is such a different thing than just selling wine through a mailing list. And so how do we want that to sort of integrate with this? And so I would say, we have a, you know, the label's now, you know, a white background instead of a black background, but we kept a lot of those characteristics the same because we did want it to continue through. And I think from a brand perspective, we really focused on not just the experience of the wine itself, drinking the wine, but what goes along with that. So we focus on things like person-to-person engagement. So we do these sit-down tastings here at the Adobe that are very intimate, personal, where you know, we'll go through and taste the wines with them and really kind of share stories at the table, rather than, you know, it's not your typical kind of put your hand out and get your tasting at the tasting bar. This is a much more intimate experience here.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.